Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
It went me today. A great occasion and a fabulous atmosphere. Well, let's take a check on the two cup final teams, starting with Chelsea.
Chelsea fans ambled into Wembley for the 1997 FA Cup final, hopeful for a change in their final fortunes.
As expected, it's the new Football of the Year, Zola, and Hughes up front, which means there's no room for Viali, although, as I was saying earlier, he is on the Chelsea bench with Craig Burley. And
it had been 26 years since their club had won major honours, but they would get a remarkable surprise as Dennis Wise assisted the fastest ever goal in an FA Cup final.
Is Dennis still claiming that he provided the assist? So he basically passed me the ball in our own half, so, and he claims that to be an assist for a goal, okay?
Wise for Chelsea. Rolled up to Di Matteo.
I ran towards Middlesbrough goal, and I remember Mark Hughes in front of me making a movement, and I just said, I'm not going to pass it to Sparky. I'm going to give it a go. It was early in the game. I mean, normally I would have passed it to Sparky. I had the sweetest shot ever, you know, from a laces, and the ball just took off like a rocket.
Hughes making an angle run ahead of him. It opened up some space, though, and a goal! Fantastic start, Roberto Di Matteo. Inside 45 seconds.
And that was the goal, and then I blanked. I can't remember, like 10 seconds or something.
See Hamlet running with the ball, and eventually thought the only option was to have the shot. And what a strike it was. The time he has on the ball, there is a simple pass to him. He looks up, he runs with it. Mark Hughes makes a tremendous run here to take the centre-half away. Watch him break away there to the side.
After the goal, I was just running like a madman, I guess.
Really, will be disappointed. That's going
people
to
trying to catch me.
Right over the top of his head.
And it may well be the fastest in FA Cup history. It's the fastest goal by 2 seconds.
From Highway 61, this is The Blueprint. I'm Kerry Levy, and together with Chelsea insider Gary Hayes, we've spent over 8 years piecing together the club's modern story. We're taking listeners inside Chelsea like never before, as the key people who transformed the club's fortunes talk us through just how they did it, changing the English game forever. The next step after Glenn Hoddle's complete rebuild of the club was to start winning things. Only they wouldn't be doing it with Hoddle at the helm, much to the disappointment of managing director Colin Hutchinson.
It's a shame, in many ways, from our point of view, that he was offered the England job in 1996. Obviously, we couldn't stand in his way. It was a great opportunity for him, but it meant then we had to make a decision with the plan.
And that plan was the result of the Marriott Accord. A 5-year blueprint to regenerate Chelsea Football Club and make the Blues a serious force again, in which Hoddle had been vital. But good work brings attention, and the Football Association had paid very good attention to what Hoddle had been doing in West London. Within 3 years, he had transformed Chelsea's fortunes. Hoddle had reinvigorated the squad, modernised the club and its playing style. European football had returned to SW6, and Chelsea were appearing more and more in the conversation for silverware. Despite all this, Hoddle wasn't expecting an international call-up. Not yet.
And I was as shocked as anyone when I got the phone call. So, you know, I had a lot of thinking to do. Not on the football front. That was your country's calling you. You know, but I was very... It's a weird one because I felt the same at Swindon when I went to Chelsea. It's ironic, isn't it? Now at Chelsea, feeling just the same. We just got Swindon up. We're just doing things at Chelsea. And I get a phone call from a bigger scenario. And I'm in the same boat again. And it was with a heavy... It's mad to say it, I suppose, but it's not heavy heart. That's too dramatic to say a heavy heart because you're going to England. You're going to manage England. But you know what I mean? There was a bit of sadness. There was a little bit of sadness that I wasn't going to finish off this job that I started and bloody worked hard at the beginning. The beginning was the toughest, tough first 1.5 seasons was... it's always tough, but that was really ridiculously tough. And I'm thinking, I'm now going to leave that behind because I knew what was going to happen there, you know, and go to England. But how could I turn the country down? I was young, but I thought, well, I never, might never, ever, ever get another chance to do this. And in the end, you know, I made that decision. But it was with a lot of sadness. It really was because I'd built up a lot of things with the players, with the staff, with everyone, really. And... I didn't feel I was letting them down because I was going to England. If I was, you know, it was just a little bit frustrating, but I got rid of that frustration quickly because obviously I was going to become England manager and we had a World Cup to go for. So it was an exciting time at the same time as being quite sad in a way. It was exciting. So my emotions were split.
He had a modernistic looking forward approach. I mean, he came in, and the training ground, he transformed it. He brought in a fitness coach, didn't have a canteen, cut out drinking beer on the team coach going back after matches, and he was in to the plan we had in mind to take the club forward.
Indeed, Chelsea had reached an FA Cup final in Hoddle's first campaign, a European semi the following year, and save for a calamitous back pass from Craig Burley, may well have returned to Wembley for the FA Cup final again in 1996. They lost 2-1 in the semis to Manchester United that season, but looking around at Chelsea, it wasn't doom and gloom, quite the opposite, because of Hoddle. Is it any wonder Ken Bates wasn't happy with his manager's premature departure? Not least because the circumstances surrounding Hoddle leaving were shrouded in controversy.
Harding came in on the scene, who sucked up to Hoddle like da-da-da-da-da. Then he had an unofficial management team down at where we used to play, Harlington. And he and Hutchinson and Harding, one other name, which we used to meet to discuss the future of Chelsea. Meanwhile, the FA were looking for a manager. So we arranged to have a meeting with his agent, Dennis Roach, and we had a working breakfast at Chelsea Harbour Hotel to thrash out Glenn's new contract. So we agreed, shook hands. 2 o'clock that afternoon, I got a phone call from Dan Hoddle saying, "Chairman, I've decided to take the English job, so I'm resigning." Oh, I said, "Don't worry, Glenn, I knew you'd taken it at 8 o'clock this morning." Dead silence. So I wished him luck and f***ed him off. 5 o'clock that afternoon, I got a phone call from Graham Kelly. Can I have permission to approach Glenn Hoddle and interview him with a view to the English job? I said, "Graham, you've been doing it for 6 months, haven't you? I've known all the time." I said, "Anyway, you're late asking for permission to approach him." Because he agreed, he rang me at 2 o'clock to tell me he agreed to take the job. So I said, "Graham, there's one question, can I ask you?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Can I refer you to rule so and so and so and so and so and so? Come on, what is it now?" He said, "Yeah, okay, what is it?" I said, "Do you know what it knows, what it says?" He said, "No, not offhand." I said, "It says that if anybody makes an illegal approach to another player's manager or player, without the previous manager's approval, they should be reported to the FA for suitable punishment. Who do I ring up in the FA to report that you have just confirmed you'd be making legal approaches to my manager? Dead silence. You know, Graham used to stutter a lot. I said, think about it, Graham, and give me your answer later, please.
Hoddle joining England threatened to stall Chelsea at the very moment the club was hinting at a renaissance. So where next? The Blues had arrived at those fabled crossroads again.
With him gone, there was talk of bringing, say, George Graham in or another established manager. But to do that would probably have stalled the plans and the approach we want to use, because of the fact a new manager wants to change so many things and wants to change the players.
Regardless of all the things club directors concern themselves with when appointing managers, those on the terraces were thinking about just one thing, and one person, as Blues supporter and author Tim Rowles tells us.
There was a hope, because we knew that Hoddle was going, and there were rumours of George Graham coming back. But I think there was a game at the end of that season, might have been against Leeds at home, where there were people chanting for Hulley, and you can stick your George Graham up your, and I won't use the next word. So I think the supporters wanted Hulley when they knew that Hoddle was going.
So we went with a policy of promoting from within. In this case, it was Ruud Gullit, rather than disturb everything. And of course, he got us going and got us to the 1997 Cup Final.
As Hutchinson explains, Cup Finals will be back on the agenda for Chelsea, which we'll get to. But first, that summer of Hoddle's departure was pivotal for the next step forward. Or would it be backward, as could have been the case? Chelsea needn't have worried. Appointing Gullit as manager was a step up from his former boss. Not in coaching terms, but in a branding exercise. This was the mid-90s, remember, a changing time when being just a football club would soon not be enough. And just as Hoddle gave Chelsea what the club had been missing from a sporting perspective, Gullit gave them in style and glamour. That he would more than prove himself adept in the dugout was a significant bonus.
What Chelsea were doing now was they were moving with the times. They were keeping up with the Joneses, if you like, because they could see Arsenal getting in someone like Dennis Bergkamp. You saw the impact that Eric Cantona had at Manchester United. And Gullit was that state. I mean, Gullit was a fantastic player. I will never forget him in the Euro 88 with Holland when he just sort of ran the show, really. Destroyed England in Dusseldorf as well.
As Mike Ingham reflects on Gullit the player, he also knew Gullit the manager would bring something more to Stamford Bridge. Global appeal. Ingham is, of course, a voice familiar to generations of football fans across the UK. Now retired from commentary, his decades-long stint on BBC Five Live narrated millions of fans through matches every week as they drove up and down the country.
Everybody knew Chelsea, but did everybody know Chelsea around the world, on the continent? I think Gullit going there, then you know, people like Viali and Zola would look at it, and he was the catalyst, if you like, for everything that then happened. Without Ruud Gullit, I think things would have happened a little slower. I'm not sure they'd have got the Desailly's and all these other people then eventually coming along to Stamford Bridge.
The stock of the Chelsea badge was rising, and the stronger that stock, the stronger the commercial proposition. It meant the club could generate more finances, in turn attract better players and ultimately win more matches. That's the winning formula in football. In Gullit, Chelsea had the solution to binding the past with the present and the future. The fundamentals of football merging with the commercial and brand importance that was fast approaching on the horizon. All those things that have come to define the modern game. And if supporters weren't watching Gullit operate from the dugout, he was on their TV screens in ads for the likes of M&M's and Pizza Hut.
Hold on.
Rod! Mr. Gullit!
Hello, Barry. Where is he?
Who?
This tasty Sicilian you'll be raving about.
Out of a dirty, ruddy old sod, it's here. One Pizza Hut Sicilian.
Pizza?
Not just a pizza. It's the only one with oregano, basil and garlic baked into the base. Mm. In wicked corners.
Sorry, Barry.
Hang on.
No, you had your 10%.
New Pizza Hut Sicilian with oregano, basil, garlic and wicked corners.
He was one of the most recognisable people in world sport. And to have him as manager of Chelsea when half a decade earlier, no disrespect, we'd had, you know, Ian Porterfield before that with Bobby Campbell, John Hollins, all football men, but not on the same planet, reputation, charisma-wise, as Ruud Gullit. He was an absolute game changer. It was, even now, sort of quarter of a century later, you think, how the heck did we A, sign him, and then B, persuade him to become manager? There must have been other clubs interested in taking it. There must have been.
It was all happening to the backdrop of Euro 96, the summer where English football wore three lions on the shirt, when football very nearly came home. The English game was suddenly becoming the place to be, and talented stars from across the continent seemed to agree. In the summer immediately after Euro 96, Arsenal signed Patrick Vieira from AC Milan. Karol Poborský and Patrick Berger, stars from the Czech Republic team that had made it to the Euros final, joined Manchester United and Liverpool respectively. Jordi Cruyff, son of the great Johan, also joined Manchester United, moving from Barcelona. But the list at Chelsea was even better.
One thing about Ruud Gullit being in charge was he obviously had fantastic contacts, personal contacts, with players that might well have been interested in coming to the club because he was there.
So who are these players that Martin Tyler is talking about? Steve Clarke was in the Chelsea dressing room watching it all unfold.
Vialli was an established international player, was a European Cup winner. Roberto Di Matteo was a current Italian international. So for Chelsea to go to Italy and bring a current Italian international over was a big thing, because at that time Serie A was possibly the biggest league in Europe. So for us to go there and take one of their key international players out of a big club like Lazio and bring him to London was certainly a big statement for Chelsea, and I think it was probably a big statement in Italy as well.
We were witnessing the next step of the journey to growing Chelsea on and off the pitch.
The chairman, Ken Bates, Colin Hutchinson, the chief executive at that time, were going out and starting to look further afield than just going up to Scotland to find a player, or going to Ireland to find a player. And suddenly we were bringing in these established international players, probably with the exception of Frank Leboeuf, who was a little bit an unknown, came in and did really well for the club. And obviously the move in November, because there was no transfer windows in those days, you could go out and improve your squad as and when. To bring in Gianfranco Zola was probably the little masterstroke that we needed just to take the level up a little bit higher.
Ah yes, Gianfranco Zola, the man everyone loves to love.
What you see with Gianfranco is what you get. Some guys come across all lovely on television, but they're not half as nice when you meet them away from the cameras. Gianfranco is a decent, humble guy. I don't know anyone that dislikes him. He's tremendous.
Gianfranco Zola was just a little genius. Took everybody's breath away when we first saw him in training. His movement, his skill, his touch, his balance, everything about him really was something that made you really pleased that he was in your team and he was helping you rather than trying to play against him. Certainly as a defender, I know that in training he probably helped to raise my level of play, because if you weren't on your toes, he could soon make a fool of you. So.
And if Glenn Hoddle had had his way, Zola would have been a Chelsea player long before Ruud Gullit brought him to the Premier League.
18 months before we signed him, we were on the trail of him. Glenn liked him as a player. I managed to track down his representative, who was a lawyer, not an agent. We had a repartee and said, would he like to come to Chelsea? And said it wasn't possible at this stage. And then about 18 months later, after Glenn had gone, I got a call from an agent representing Parma Football Club. They were coming to England to sort out, try and do a deal for Zola. They came to see me on the Wednesday night. We talked, took it so far down the line, but they couldn't finish it. They then didn't say it, but I knew they were going to try and get Tottenham interested. I then rang the guy, his representative, and told him what was happening, and got on to Parma and arranged to see their president. So Thursday, off to Italy, Milan, and then out to Parma to meet the president. At about midnight, we did a deal. The next morning, I met the lawyer. We sorted the personal details out for Gianfranco. Early afternoon, he came and signed. And I don't think Tottenham had ever got out of the starting blocks before we signed him.
I think signing that level of player, so all those players, Gianluca Vialli was a different type who came in and showed everybody a great work ethic. Gianluca found it difficult to settle into English football. He found it difficult to find the rhythm of English football, but he was so determined. His mentality and his application to training, his application to matches was something that you could learn from. And I think a lot of players at that time probably did learn from Gianluca. And then similarly, Roberto Di Matteo came in. He was in the team and always a really consistent level. And then we brought in the little maestro in November, and he brought a whole bundle of tricks that raised everybody's morale and confidence, and the team could only get better and better with those type of players around the club.
When Gianfranco Zola came, I think apart from the fact that the club didn't have a shirt of the right size for him to wear in his first game, I think the scene had been set for this crossover really between the local lads. I mean, you know, when I first watched Chelsea, the youngsters were as much a part of it as the Busby Babes, really, in the 60s. The Chelsea produced so many players of their own late 50s, early 60s, wonderful players. Not all of them stayed. Jimmy Greaves, I saw play for Chelsea, and probably one of the best players I've ever seen in his Chelsea days, ever. Wonderful. And obviously moved on. Chelsea couldn't keep them. Now Chelsea were in a situation where, as the Premier League was gathering momentum and the club's finances were a little bit better off, I'm never quite sure how much. I mean, it seemed to be going to the brink one minute and then Zola was arriving the next, you know. You couldn't really square that up. And the one thing that I've never really got into as a commentator is the finances of it, because you never get told the truth. And yeah, suddenly, I mean, there was always glamour at Chelsea, but some of it had disappeared with the relegations and the difficult years. But even then, you know, Kerry Dixon, David Speedy, all that side in the late 80s, they were exciting even in the old second division. So this was the right stage. I think Chelsea have a great advantage with their location. Players want to come and live in London. They certainly want to come and live in southwest London. So they were cashing in.
The stage was set, and as that season progressed, Chelsea continued to capture the imagination of the fan base as they dreamt of success. But before eyes could turn to silverware, tragedy would strike the club, as we'll learn about after this short break.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello everyone, this is Gary speaking. Now, you won't be hearing my voice in this series, rather just Kerry reading the words that I write. But while I'm leaving him to expertly narrate the Blueprint story, I'm cutting in for a moment to tell you all about Blueprint Plus. It's a new subscription service for those of you listening on Apple Podcasts. Blueprint Plus means you'll be able to hear every episode of the series completely ad-free. And when we release a new series, because we're going to do another series, subscribers will get to hear every episode of that first before anyone else. Subscribers will also have access to all of our upcoming bonus episodes, and we've got plenty of them coming up too. We're releasing the full interviews with Glenn Hoddle, Colin Hutchinson, Steve Clark, and most of the other voices you're hearing throughout the Blueprint. There'll be other narrative episodes available as well, as after our main series run, we'll be digging a little deeper into certain aspects of the Chelsea story that we won't have time to expand on in a normal episode. And after conducting over 180 interviews, we still have so much more to deliver. Blueprint Plus is available now for just 99p a month, and you can cancel your subscription at any time. I've also been told by the legal department that subscription prices may vary depending on the territory you're in. So if you want more insider stories from Stamford Bridge, ad-free streaming and exclusive access, then subscribe to Blueprint Plus for just 99p. And besides all of what we're offering, subscribing does mean you'll be supporting an independent podcast series. So if you listen on Apple, you just need to tap that subscriber button and let your phone do the rest. It's that simple. So now I'll get back to typing so Kerry has something to read.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
For those who lived it, Wednesday the 23rd of October 1996 is a date anyone connected with Chelsea cannot forget. That morning, the football world woke to the news that Chelsea vice chairman Matthew Harding had tragically died in a helicopter crash the night before, aged just 42. He had been travelling back to London after watching the Blues in the League Cup.
It was at Bolton in the what's now the Carabao Cup. And I scored a goal, and actually it was a pretty good goal. It was a pretty good run. It was a pretty feeble shot, and the keeper should have saved it, but I'd settle for it.
The goal Chelsea left-back Scott Minto describes would be the last Matthew Harding saw from a Chelsea player.
We ended up losing 2-1, and he'd obviously flown up and tried to fly back. And when we heard it, yeah, the club was, we were all just, because, you know, this was this guy who was going to, you know, help out the club. I know we knew he was close to Glenn. He came in a couple of times at the training ground, but not often. And I didn't really speak to him personally. But, you know, this is this guy, this big Chelsea fan who's willing to put money in and take Chelsea even further from what base he can do, either with him or who knows if he'd sort of take over the club himself. And, yeah, it was just a really surreal moment sort of being told in the next few days. And although he didn't know him, it felt like he was part of the family. It was a really strange feeling.
In a world without social media and instant messaging, news of the accident started to filter through early the next morning. David Lee is one of the players who recalls being informed by a member of the Chelsea staff.
So I got back from Bolton on the Tuesday night, went home, and then between 6 and 7 the next morning, the club secretary, Teresa Connolly, rang me to deliver the bad news that Matthew had been involved in the helicopter crash and said not to come in, just wait by the phone and we'll be in contact with you to let you know what the next port of call is as such. So, you know, I've come off the phone like, you know, absolutely devastated and went downstairs and put the telly on and, you know, it all unfolded what happened. It was a big shock, to be fair, you know, not nice. And then, you know, the worst thing about it is you have people calling you all the time. You know, we had journalists, journalists calling what happened and I'm like, you know, no comment, you know, speak to the club or whatever. The club then rang us and told us we were in on the Thursday. And we came in on the Thursday and the manager sat us down, Rude sat us down and just said what had happened, told us all, you know, and it was very somber, the mood. The training was like, you know, whatever. And it was very difficult, very, very difficult at the time.
Mark Killick and David Cooper were friends of Harding's. Killick would regularly attend Chelsea with Harding, flying to away matches on Jackie Stewart's private jet, while Cooper also worked with Harding as his lawyer.
I think based on a conversation that he'd had with Tony Blair, he realised that there was a helicopter that he could charter for trips going forward.
This helicopter was the same helicopter, same pilot that Tony Blair had used, which is how we got the reference. And Matthew had ordered it for six matches, all of which was for Manchester and North. And this, believe it or not, was the first match that he'd used the helicopter for.
Some will remember that prior to the Bolton game, we had a home game against Wimbledon. And it was at that game that he actually said to me, because he always called me Marky Mark, and he said, Marky Mark, Bolton away in the Cup. He said, are you coming? We're going by a helicopter. I actually sort of hesitated a little bit and said, I don't know whether I can, Matt. I'll let you know. And Ray stood next to me. He said, Ray, you coming? Ray said, yeah, I'll come. So Ray went on that particular trip.
That's Ray Dean, who was one of three other passengers who travelled with Harding and died when the helicopter came down, the others being John Baldy and Tony Burridge. The pilot was Michael Goss.
So I just watched it at home. I think it was, I remember watching it on TV. I'm sure I did, you know, sort of, and whether it was just highlights I might have watched.
Cooper himself could have been on the helicopter too.
I was actually at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, sitting at the roulette table with my wife, who was a gaming lawyer, and she was at a gaming conference, and I went there as a sort of, with her as a visiting spouse, you know, and we got a, stood at the table, which I suppose would have been 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock their time, so it would have been quite late in the UK, and two of these sort of armed guards came along with reflective sunglasses and said, are you Mr. and Mrs. Cooper? And we said, yes. They said, we've got some rather bad news for you. I think, at which stage, I think my wife nearly fainted. And we went back to the room and we got a recorded call from the nanny who was looking after the kids while we were away. And at least the first bit of the recorded call said, listen, it's dreadful news, but it doesn't affect the family. And what Bates had done was he had rang her, and she apparently then rang Caesar's Palace to say that the helicopter had come down with, Matthew in it. And the only news the next day in the newspapers was that Matthew Harding and an entourage were killed. Now, I was due on that helicopter. What actually happened was this, that the helicopter came down on a Tuesday. The match originally was supposed to be at Bolton on a Wednesday.
The game had been moved forward as Manchester United's original League Cup tie with Swindon Town was pushed back 24 hours as they had played in the Premier League on the Sunday.
Now, I was due back to get on that helicopter on the Wednesday. But when it was brought back to the Tuesday, I couldn't get a plane from Las Vegas. And so I told Matthew, or Matthew's secretary, and some other poor bugger took my place on the helicopter.
I used to travel with Matthew quite a bit. He hired private jets and what have you. And I could have probably been on that helicopter, but for some reason I decided to go on the executive coach. And I was on the executive coach coming back, and I got a call from Gwyn Williams on the team coach to say that a helicopter had gone down, and there was a fear that it was probably Matthew.
Went to bed with you know, no thoughts. I'd know Matthew had got up there. I spoke to him that morning because he'd got back from a business trip the day before. He'd had a reinsurance meeting out in Germany. I said, oh, I'll give you a call tomorrow after the game. We'll have a chat about the game. First thing I remember personally is sort of waking up on the morning after the game and putting on sort of radio and hearing reports of a helicopter that had come down and reports were that were directors from one of the football clubs on the flight. So I knew straight away, you know, I knew straight away. And I also had the thought that when a helicopter comes down, you know, usually they come down.
And at 5:30 the next morning, got the call to say that it was. And the eerie thing was, there were press people and agents ringing my home number to speak to me. In other words, they were truly trying to find out whether I was still alive. You know, so, yeah, that still lives with me to today.
And so I phoned a few people. It became quite apparent that it was Matthew's flight. And it was almost a little bit of a moment for me, because Matthew only made his will in the May beforehand.
Harding had asked Killick to be an executor of his will, so this meant he would be involved in managing his late friend's estate and the ongoing relationship with Chelsea, which is discussed in more detail in the Matthew Harding tapes that preceded the full release of the blueprint.
Obviously, I'd acted for Matthew. I'd actually persuaded him to do a will, which is probably the best thing I ever did. And I must say, I shall never forget what he said to me for a lifetime, which is, I don't want to do a will because if I do a will, I have this superstition that I'll die prematurely. And that's what he said. And I said, don't be stupid, just do it. So there you go.
But this is the football and business side of the tragedy. Behind the headlines and news bulletins, there was a family that had lost a husband and a father. We have spoken with two of Harding's sons for the blueprint. Luke and Joel recall the impact in the immediate aftermath of their dad's tragic passing. The first voice you will hear is Luke, followed by his younger brother Joel.
So I remember a few months before the accident, he was talking about getting a helicopter, using a helicopter to go to and from games, how it would save time. One afternoon, this field where we played the crossbar challenge with Glenn Hoddle, that same field, he turned up in a helicopter. He was saying he was going to land in the back garden in a helicopter.
I can remember a helicopter landing in our garden at one point when he started to use that sort of mode of transport, if you like, to get around and get to games and everything else. Can't remember whether it was the same one or if that was connected. It did become an easier way for him to travel, I guess.
It was just like, wow, is that safe? You know, is that okay? I presume it must be. Anyway, so he landed in the garden on this afternoon, and we all jumped in and took off and did a kind of little lap of the area. And it's kind of, if you've ever been in a helicopter, it's quite a surreal thing with the glass, almost a glass floor, seeing the earth move away from you. It's, I don't know, it can be a little scary if you're scared of heights, I suppose, being in a helicopter. It's not for everyone. Did think about the safety aspect of being on a helicopter, and was it completely safe? And, you know, as you'd imagine, you'd kind of say, yeah.
I never really thought in that way. You don't really, do you? I guess, otherwise no one would go on them. It was quite usual for him to be travelling via a jet to an away game or something. Didn't really make much difference whether it was a helicopter or a plane, to be quite honest.
The night in question, yeah, we played Bolton away. He went straight from work. No family members went with him on that occasion.
Don't recall anything about the day generally, other than I remember just being sat at home watching. He wasn't on the TV, so I must have watching teletext and a bit of radio, I think, just keeping an eye on the game. And I remember just going to bed thinking, we've lost 2-1. Thought nothing of it. You know, it wasn't unusual to be going to bed on a midweek night thinking, Chelsea have lost again midweek, you know. Worry about it in the morning.
For some unknown reason, I remember sticking on a music video that I had, like a compilation of my favourite MTV songs kind of thing. And I remember Guns N' Roses, November Rain coming on at about, I don't know, 10, half 10. It was just on a video. So I remember kind of watching that and just kind of feeling a bit strange, like something weird's going on. And then I went to bed not long after that. I remember the dog was howling on the balcony. And that was like weird as well. Like, Max has never howled on the balcony before. Why is he howling?
Then I remember waking up in the morning, normal school day, right? And I suddenly thought, God, it feels late. sort of trying to look at the clock, and it was about, I can't remember what it was now, I want to say sort of 8 o'clock, you think, well, I'm struggling for time here. What's gone on? Why have I not been woken up? And then I remember looking out sort of onto the driveway, and it was just cars everywhere. I thought, it's a bit odd, what's going on?
And I kind of had a feeling like something weird had already happened, because I was getting a feeling the night before. And I could hear my sister crying in my mother's bedroom. And yeah, just going in, asking what had happened. Mum saying there's an accident. And it's like, is it Dad? Yeah. Is he going to be okay? And then it's like, nope.
And then I just remember my mum coming up the stairs and sitting down with me and just explaining that there's been an accident, you know, and it's Dad. And thinking, right, okay. And then becoming quite clear that it was serious. And she said, yeah, he's been in a helicopter accident and he's died. You don't really know, you're in shock, aren't you? You don't know what to say or think, you know, I'm, what, 12 years old? And I've probably never really given enough credit for having to have that conversation with me and my brothers and my sister while dealing with it herself. And yeah, it's just a shock, you just go numb.
And then you kind of can't breathe for a while.
I was thinking, that can't be right. And then you put the TV on. And I guess normal situations, you don't have that, right? You turn the TV on and it's BBC and ITV and it's all showing it, and there's images of the field and everything else.
Begun the inquiry into the crash, which killed Chelsea co-owner Matthew Harding and four others. The French twin-engine helicopter came down just before 11 p.m. It quickly became clear that it had been en route to London from Chelsea's match at Bolton.
Then it's just... it was just a bombardment of phone calls to the house with press reporters and people outside the house, paparazzi and reporters trying to get stories. And I don't know, that probably made it a little bit harder.
So you start to process it, don't you? Then all the press were obviously at the gate. So you got all the paparazzi and press and photographers and everything like that. And the house just full of people. And then, yeah, you start to try and process it, really, at that point. I just remember being angry at the time. But probably not necessarily with them, but just you're angry with the situation. So and then you sort of think, well, they're all there, and they're sort of trying to get a better angle. Can they get in? Can they break through the sort of hedge or the fence and that kind of thing? So you're just a bit sort of, you're just angry anyway. And that's probably a tipping point.
Lots of weird stories coming out, like... Did he survive for a while after the crash, I remember seeing, but I don't know, yeah. I never forget the evening personally, obviously. But yeah, I got a lot of respect from my peers at school. They give me a lot of space and support. So yeah, sad time for me and my brothers and sisters.
Well, it was, I mean, we were all in shock. The first big decision that had to be taken was the following Sunday's match with Tottenham, should it be postponed or go ahead. Knowing Matthew as we did, we knew he would have wanted to go ahead, and it did. And, I mean, Alan Sugar said to me after the match, we never had a chance in that emotional atmosphere. I mean, they're just overrun because the crowd and all the flowers and everything, you know, it was a very emotional day.
It had the air of a memorial service rather than a football match, as the Chelsea faithful paid their tributes for many hours before the kickoff against Tottenham. Seldom, if ever, can a club...
I found it quite heartwarming to see the sort of outpouring of love for him. He was quite comforting in a way. But seeing all the people laying flowers and people being interviewed outside the ground... ...had been chasing.
My words can't express, you know, how the fans feel about him. He was man of the fans. It's almost as like one of us has died and we can't see our beloved Chelsea anymore.
I liked him. He was a very nice man. I'd spoken to him a few times and I found he was very friendly with all the people.
I never spoken to him, but he's a friend. Friend to everybody. You've only got to look in there and see the tribute. It speaks for itself.
You know, you asked me earlier on, was it difficult separating your sort of your dad from the Matthew Harding at Chelsea? And that really highlighted how important he was to people. Because you don't think, well, you know, you're sort of thinking, is my dad? Why are people so bothered about him? Why are they so, you know, why did he make such a difference to their sort of their feeling about Chelsea? And when you see them all like that, and going, taking their time out of their days, travelling in to go and just put some flowers down as a mark of respect, is phenomenal. Silence.
Testimony to a common belief that it wasn't just Chelsea who'd lost a unique supporter. So too had football.
I remember, you know, standing around and we had the reef that we put out. And it was against Spurs, where obviously we had that really good run against them anyway, or historically. So we felt like we couldn't lose against Spurs and certainly shouldn't lose against Spurs. But actually, this was a game where we literally felt we cannot lose and we will not lose. I think it was almost like a 3-1 drubbing. We just felt that we had to do it for Matthew. Yeah, it was just a really, really surreal, really bad moment, you know, even though Glenn wasn't sort of at the club anymore. It was horrible, a horrible time, obviously, for his family and people close to him.
As Scott Minto reflects, Hoddle was England manager now, but the loss of Harding still left a significant void in his life.
Totally, you know, totally upsetting and shocking. I was just totally shocked. I couldn't believe it. Yeah, one of those things that jolt you, and well, yeah, I was, yeah, for quite a long time. I was obviously I knew the family, and it was tough. It was a tough time for the family and everyone, really, because he was such a lovable character. I mean, he was a rogue, but he was a lovable rogue, and he was a character. He was such fun. He was full of life. To think that it just, you know, his life was just taken like that was absolutely shocking to his family, number one, but and so sad for everyone involved with Chelsea and who knew him. It was very, very sad day when I heard that. I was shocked. I wasn't in that job where you're daily, day to day. So I was scouting or things like that. So I had a lot of time to think about our times together. It wasn't like, you know, if you're in a full-time job, you'd think about it, you'd have your moments, and then you go back, try and get back into your life, don't you? But I remember I had a bit of time at that time. I was scouting for England players and whatever, so I wasn't full on training every day. So it stayed with me for probably longer, 4 or 5 days. And the funeral was tough, you know. And it was there, you always think of the family, you know. You think the families, and it was just a sad loss because, you know, he was in his pomp, really, as a person. And he had his business and he had his love of Chelsea, and yeah, very, very sad.
Following Harding's funeral, a memorial service was held. Among the speakers was Tony Blair, the leader of the Labour Party, who a few months later was elected as UK Prime Minister.
It's a real privilege for me to be with you here today and to take part in this celebration of Matthew's life. Matthew could be, on occasions in his language, how can I put it, a trifle colourful. And we were sitting there having this discussion, and he finally said to me, you know, I mean, is it just my money that you're interested in? I mean, put it even more colourfully than that. And I thought, well, I'm a politician, but what the hell, I'll be honest. And I said to him, look, Matthew, to be quite honest about it, yes, we do need your money because they've got a lot of money and we don't. And he looked at me and said, fair enough. He said, how much do you want then? Just like that. He was quite different from all the presidents and prime ministers and diplomats you have in your room. I tell you my impression of him as an individual, because he was a remarkable man. It's an impression of a man of seeming contradictions. He was larger than life, as we can see, and yet utterly full of humanity. He was self-made, and yet he was completely devoted to others. And perhaps above all else, if I had to try and characterise him, I'd say he was that extraordinary and curious mixture of insecurity at one level, combined with the utter confidence he could take on the world and beat it at another, that is the hallmark often of people who are both successful and people who really give something back to the life they lead. Recently, I was Ruth's guest at Chelsea's game at home to Manchester United, and I sat in the director's box with her. My children and hers were in the seats directly above the letters of Matthew's name on the Matthew Harding stand behind the goal to our right. And I think I felt his presence there, and we all feel his presence here today with us. And I mourn the loss of a force for good, taken away before all the good that was in him could come out. And yet, we all of us know, in all our different ways, no matter how well we knew him or how little, no matter how much he touched our lives or not, we all know that we will not forget Matthew Harding, that today's celebration of life is a genuine celebration, that we feel it in our hearts and in our minds. And today especially, we recall his life, and we recall it with affection and with gratitude, and we say to him, thank you for all that you did.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Matthew Harding's last words to Colin Hutchinson were almost prophetic.
I'll never forget the night he was tragically killed. We played Bolton that night and we lost. And after the match, my final conversation with him was, he said, oh, we'll have to win the FA Cup then. And of course we did.
Enter Roberto Di Matteo, Chelsea's Italian midfield maestro who set the Blues on course for a date with history.
After the goal, I was just running like a madman, I guess. People trying to catch me.
Inside 45 seconds. And it may well be the fastest in FA Cup history. It's the fastest goal by 2 seconds.
I had the sweetest shot ever, you know, from a laces, and the ball just took off like a rocket. And that was the goal. And then I blanked. I can't remember, like 10 seconds or something. After the goal, I was just running like a madman, I guess. People trying to catch me.
Everything that had passed, Hoddle's arrival, the signing of Hullett, Mark Hughes and others, the Bosman ruling, Hoddle's departure, the appointment of Hullett to replace him, Ken Bates saving the club from extinction, the Chelsea pitch owners, that 1994 defeat, Matthew Harding's millions, his death, the jubilation, fear, ecstasy and pain, it was all bottled up within 42 seconds of brilliance.
There was a little bit of nervousness. There was a little bit of that, you know, edge within the team, of course. It's a final. Anything can happen in a final. You know that you have a chance, but everybody was conscious that it was an important game for the future of every individual player, but also the club, because of the many years that the club hadn't won a trophy, hadn't been involved in a European competition and so on. So we knew the importance of it and we were ready for it. I remember the night before the final in the hotel, I remember that, you know, obviously I was a little bit nervous, and I remember Ruud coming up to me and say, "Lovely boy, don't worry about it. Just enjoy yourself tomorrow." And it sort of relaxed me a bit. I did enjoy myself. Yeah, I think we all had a very good game, and it was very enjoyable. Especially, you know, when you win, it's obviously more enjoyable. It was just a perfect afternoon. You know, going ahead early in the game settled us down a bit, gave us, you know, the belief and the confidence, and then obviously the second goal was a little bit of a cushion. And but you know, Middlesbrough fought very hard, and they played a good game. I guess we were just a bit strong on the day.
Ruud Gullit was one of the most decorated players of his generation. He won European Cups, league titles, the European Championships with Holland, and the Ballon d'Or. But even he didn't expect the magnitude of emotions that engulfs an FA Cup final.
I think I didn't realise, because everybody was talking about the FA Cup, what it means for people who live in, and I didn't know. And till the moment that I had to enter Wembley Stadium to go on the pitch with the opposition, and then I was like, now I know what it's all about. And it was one of the best days of my life. And it was, for me, so good to see, because I knew that a long time we haven't won anything. And I saw the faces of the fans, I saw the faces of the players, and Mark Hughes telling me, you know, that you're on the end of my career, you know, we were winning this trophy, and he was so happy with it. Seeing Dennis there as Mr. Chelsea getting this trophy made me happy.
Chelsea would win the game 2-0, securing their first major trophy beneath the famous Twin Towers of Wembley. Eddie Newton had been part of the team that lost to Manchester United in 94. He gave away one of the penalties that Eric Cantona converted in that 4-0 loss. But redemption was his against Middlesbrough, scoring Chelsea's second.
When we got to the 97, it was totally different. Totally, totally different, because when I walked into that dressing room, it was so quiet. So quiet. Everyone was just so focused on their job, what they had to do, what to deliver. I remember walking out, I felt like I was going to go, I'm going to war, you know, because it's D-Day for me. Coming back to this place where I let myself down, you know, in the previous season, the previous FA Cup, this time it wasn't meant to be. This time it wasn't going to be, you know. No stepping back, no nothing. I was going all out. So mentally focused, mentally driven to do whatever I had to do to win this game. There was a real feeling in that dressing room, a real tension, but not nervous tension. It was a tension of, we're ready, we're prepared, we believe in each other, and now we need to make it happen. We need to get over that line. This is really important. We have to get over that line and we have to win something, because everyone's talking and muting about us like being potential winners of a cup, or, you know, starts challenging for the league and the way we're playing and so on and so forth. But we had to prove it. We had to do it. And now we're in this final and we have to cross that final barrier and win the FA Cup, not just be finalists and lose again. So that's what I felt in the dressing room, and we got off to the best possible start with Robbie. And then, obviously, I really put the ghost to bed at the end of the game when I was able to score the final goal. For me, it was fantastic.
For Bates, it was confirmation of the journey he had started 15 years earlier.
I sat there, as I did the day we won the European Cup. We were champions of Europe. I sat there just looking around, enjoying it, watching all our fans doing things, seeing things. they never ever dreamt they'd do in their wildest dreams. That was my greatest satisfaction. Always has been, because I've been one of them.
If Bates enjoyed 97 that much, he had even more to come. The Blues would go on to lift the FA Cup again in 2000, becoming the last team to win the trophy at the old Wembley.
It wasn't as good as the first one, I have to say. The first one was a real blood rush to your head and, you know, adrenaline pumping through your body. The second one wasn't. It was great. Don't get me wrong. It was really good. It was great winning the last FA Cup in the old Wembley, scoring as well. It was fantastic. But it didn't have the same excitement, if I may say.
That victory over Aston Villa added to the League Cup the Blues won in 98, the same year they lifted the Cup Winners' Cup and the Super Cup.
That's when we became champions of Europe. And we got a letter from the president of UEFA congratulating us on winning the European Cup Winners' Cup and welcoming to the European elite. And another letter, similar letter, from the General Secretary of UEFA. Not bad for a club that had never won anything, as long as Ken Bates was chairman.
In 4 years, Chelsea had won four trophies and finished third in the Premier League, which meant qualification for the Champions League. All this for a club that in the previous quarter of a century had shown plenty of promise, but never quite delivered. As we headed into a new millennium, Chelsea weren't just back. The club was headed to places it had never been. But at what cost?
First of all, I think we were all aware, also the fans and the media, that the club had financial issues. I remember springtime, there were rumours about not getting salaries. There were rumours about Ken Bates wanted to sell the club. We did not buy any players that summer, the summer before 2002, because of the financial situation.
Could Chelsea's very existence be under threat within a few years? Would the club's future rest on a single game? That's next time on The Blueprint. If you've liked what you've heard already, please give us a 5-star rating and tell your friends about The Blueprint. The Blueprint has been written and produced by Gary Hayes and me, Kerry Levy. Our theme music, Blue Day 23, was composed by Mike Canaris, with bed arrangements by Jake Bradford Sharp, and is used under license from Macasso Music. Vocals are by The Blueprinters, Alison Bender, Chiara Cervazio, Karen Edith Miller, Louis Beneventi, Daniel Childs, and Gary and myself. Leon Radchinsky-Gorman has mixed the series, and Mark Jardine is our designer. Consultant producers for the series are Nick Lapworth, Neil Pacchietto, and Jackie Anklin. We would also like to thank Gary Link from The Missing Link, Taylor Hayes, and everyone who has spoken to us for this series, on and off the record. If you like this series, please share it with your friends and give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. You've been listening to another Highway 61 production. For more podcasts like this one, visit www.highway61.media. That's HWY61.media.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.